Do you have a yard up there for her and stuff? There's some good places.
So House CNRA committee meeting to order, 27th meeting on Monday, the 23rd of March. Time is 1:45 PM. I note for the record, we do have a quorum. Representative Gonzalez, Representative Sherry Davis, Representative Mackey, Representative Baker, Representative Betty Davis, and I believe Representative Foster is just here, but not here. On the agenda today is House Bill 350 requiring certain general law in home rule cities. Unified municipalities can provide area-wide police protection and law enforcement services. Also, House Bill 390, issuance of general obligation bonds in the amount of $313 million for the purpose of paying the cost of acquiring, constructing, and constructing and equipping the schools. House Bill 350. Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are we on teleconference?
Yeah.
Okay. I know for the record that Representative Foster is also present.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Dick Burton. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety. Trying to get over a cold with sore throat, so my voice is coming and going. House Bill 350, it's an act to require certain cities to provide area-wide police protection. Is a bill was introduced for the request of the governor for correction of what we see as some loopholes, I guess you would call it, in the municipal corporation statutes of Title 29. The history of that, prior to statehood, to become a first-class city, you had to provide your own police, you had to provide jails, you had to provide a number of things. For some reason, over time, the statutes now only provide for three mandatory services: power to raise taxation, taxes, education, and planning and zoning or land use. Every municipality has the authority of a municipality commonly given to them, which is the delegation of powers from the state down to the municipal level to exercise police powers. But we find that there's a patchwork quilt of application, the way these are applied around the state. As an example, of course, one of the ones that's been most common in the forefront of everybody's news media in the last year or so has been the municipality of Anchorage. As a home rule municipality of the city and the borough combining, their charter allows them to have service areas which are decided by the majority of the people who live in the service area whether they want to be taxed to have police powers and certain other powers. There are three such municipalities, if I'm not mistaken. I'm sure there's some people in the audience who would be happy to correct me when I'm wrong, that have the unified type government. Juneau, Sitka, and Anchorage are three of those. The borough government in the North Slope borough is entirely different. That is a borough government which has cities within its boundaries, where these others have combined the cities and boroughs to become a unified municipality. Once upon doing this, the city of Sitka became a combined municipality. They were the first ones. They went area-wide immediately, and at that time, with the exception of the assistance when they called for it, or the recruit academy and the training trooper academy, we closed down our trooper club. Juneau was elected progressively to become a little more and more. They've taken over Douglas Island, had gone out as far as Brotherhood Bridge, still did not provide a service on an area-wide basis, although they can do so simply by a vote of their assembly. Then you have the other side, where you have first-class cities, and the difference in the way to do it. Wasilla is a first-class city, has been one for a number of years, has no police department at all, yet you take the small community of Haines of about 1,500, is a first-class city, sitting in a rather depressed area as far as being able to provide the money to do it, but they have their own police department, as a number of other small communities I'm sure you're familiar with, especially in the southeast, with Chairman Craig and a number of Tuna and other places provide their own law enforcement. This bill, then, is what we see as a way of correcting this problem where it's a choice of either having your own police or not. And the Hillside area in particular is one where I'm caught in the middle and having to still provide a minimum level of service to an area like that where I think the role of the state police and state troopers is more one of rural nature or outside the urban. They're not a metropolitan or a municipal type police department as they're intended to be. Therefore, you know, we certainly support this as the governor does and ask for you to consider getting it out for a vote and correcting this kind of a problem to level the playing field for law enforcement in the state of Alaska.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Questions? Okay. Representative Davis, Sherry Davis.
Sure. Thank you. Commissioner, I guess I'm a little confused as to who this would affect that isn't doing this now.
Well, primarily, there are three places. That's the Hillside area of Anchorage, the city of Wasilla, and there's one other which I can't think except that, well, any others that I can think of that would be incorporated but do not have their own law enforcement, and there are not very many of them. For the most part, most places are doing this.
I can follow up on that. I guess I'm curious why you limited it to communities that have chosen to be unified. For instance, and this may not be taken very well by my home community, but Ketchikan is on a road system, the borough has a road system, most of the residents are on the road system and are provided with trooper protection outside of the city because they have not chosen to be unified. Is there any kind of, was there any kind of thought given to looking at those communities that would fall in that category as well, or are we kind of unique in that situation?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's why I explained there's only three unified municipalities. The rest of them are like Ketchikan. You have a borough and a city. You've got two governments. You've got two governing bodies. You've got a city council. You've got a borough assembly. Title 29 allows for that. There are no second-class boroughs or no police power of the boroughs except for the North Slope borough that I know of, with the exception of where they unified the borough and municipality and became a giant municipality as far as government goes in one governing body. So you've got all kinds of ways of doing this. And that's what, this is one way that, I mean, how do you decide on anything? You pick some arbitrary figure, and most of the communities we figure 2,000, well, a lot of them smaller than that are not incorporated at all. And that's certainly the kind, and of course, Representative Gonzalez can tell you the problems of representing an area which has those kind of communities like Healy and those that are not incorporated, but really truly have a need for the services that I provide. The Fairbanks area is another example of Fairbanks and Ketchikan are both cities inside a borough. The population immediately outside the city of Fairbanks has grown in that university district like you wouldn't believe, yet the city has not seen it clear to expand their city limits, so that's forcing the pressure on me and the number and type of crimes we have, where I've got to pick these people out of places like Healy not to come and respond to that. So, you know, we're not getting a lot more troopers. We're just getting a lot more work in different places that should be municipal in nature.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, just one more point then. You don't have the ability to do the reverse, to take the troopers from an area like outside of Fairbanks or outside of Ketchikan and put them someplace where you need them in a rural area. Thus sort of forcing the issue, or do you already have that authority?
I have the authority by statute to do, just put them where I think the need is. And the way we're assessing this is by looking at crime rates, and especially violent crimes, and where that's happening. And that's my first priority, violent crimes.
Okay. Any others? Thank you, Commissioner. Scott Burgess.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Scott Burgess from the Alaska Municipal League. Mr. Chairman, you know, the league has for a long time opposed this bill based on the issue of mandates. And an issue that you folks have discussed here, we've discussed before you. I think it's not so much the specifics of the issue in terms of whether we sitting here think Anchorage or Wasilla should have police power or not. I guess it's an issue of us or the legislature making a decision for an amount of local service. Again, I understand from a financial standpoint in terms of the state, and I think it's certainly within your power if you think that the state should no longer provide service state trooper service in those areas, then, you know, through the budget process and working with the administration, should remove those folks from that area. I think the issue is one of determining, to the degree possible, to allow a community to determine its level of service. And if in fact they think that they want a higher level of service, that they do so. I can tell you, times are tough in the municipalities. I think Mr. Gonzalez, Representative Gonzalez, knows that Manana, this issue was raised in terms of that service being withdrawn as a local decision. And it is true. It is something that they have the right under current law to make. This is not something that's mandated on them now. There are other communities, I believe, that I've heard discussions too. Again, I'm not sitting here saying that I think that those areas should have police or shouldn't have police. I think it's a question of this body making a decision for local voters in terms of the level of service that they want. And I've had that discussion. And so based on that concept alone, and we have had the discussion on this specific bill within the board, and the issue of mandate over whether someone who may in fact be on one of these assemblies also sits on my board feels another way, questions perhaps maybe the league. This isn't an area that we should be pushing so hard on, but until I'm told otherwise, we view this as a mandate, and an unfunded one at that. And to some degree, I think you folks are looking at it as the fact that it's not an unfunded mandate, it's a funded service, funded local service. And I understand that approach. I'm just telling you, I mean, again, I think I can't be put in a position of saying this is a good mandate and that's a bad mandate.
Right.
And that's, I'm glad to answer any questions.
Okay. I understand you're in a very difficult situation here on this issue, because I think obviously our committee feels strongly about mandates and so forth, otherwise we would have never introduced some of the bills that we did on behalf of AML. But I mean, this is really a unique situation here as I view this, and you and I had this very same conversation today in my office. And we're faced with a hillside, which I don't represent, but I mean, I've been familiar with the problem. First of all, I'm having a trooper pulled out of Yakutat out of my district too, because the case loads and because the trooper's more needed than other places. That's not my decision to make. So I can understand, like Johnny, when they lost a trooper up there, how important that is. But you know, you have an area like a hillside within the municipality of Anchorage. Those people need to have police protection, whether they want it or they don't want it, or they're willing to vote it in or they're not willing to vote it in. And if the state doesn't have the resources to provide the troopers for that protection within the municipality of Anchorage, where they cover everybody else, I mean, we have a unique situation there. And what's to stop any other municipality from just zeroing out its ordinances for their own police departments or whatever, and then throw that burden of responsibility upon the state to have to go and enforce that? I think there's a certain amount of weight to the situation that the state is in right now, and they can't just turn their back on the hillside. I mean, those are folks there, you know. If they got somebody breaking into their house or shooting up the town, they need to have somebody respond. I don't view this as just mandating a bunch of more expense and everything onto a municipality when they already have that service and should be providing that service to their communities. Even my little town has to scrape up enough money to provide its police protection, because we can't justify having a trooper there all the time, you know. So this is kind of a unique, but maybe you can clarify maybe where I'm missing the boat there.
No, Mr. Chairman, I you know, again, I hear you. It's because of these kinds of issues that we push for the task force that's now underway in terms of governmental roles. I mean, there are things that I think as the state cuts back in terms of costs or revenues available that are going to have to become, I mean, I think all of us have some sense of what's a traditional local service and what's a traditional state service, and in fact there's some things I would submit that are neither, and that the state provides and perhaps even local governments provide. But, you know, there are things in terms of arbitrariness, in terms of 2,000. I mean, why 2,000 for police service, 10,000 for prosecution services, and no number for jails, which are sort of the other bills that you and I have talked about that are also sort of in the same vein. Mm-hmm. And I think that the difference is, one, in terms of, say, your own community. I would submit that you're the citizens in Craig wanted a higher level. I mean, they wanted a greater response than they could get from the troopers. And I would submit, well, I mean, they're paying for it. And as we know, they don't have to. I mean, they could just rely on a trooper or maybe a VPSO, but that they want something. They're feeling that's where they want to stick their money over something else. I mean, maybe other people.
Okay, just on that point, I agree with you on the mandates, you know, and that's why we introduced the bill, because the other committee members feel very strongly about mandating additional expense. But when every other municipality in the whole state is taking care of this service, with the exception of two or maybe three that the commissioner talked about, there's a major discrepancy there.
At 2,000?
Yeah. 2,000 or above.
Yeah, I mean, there are two that at the 2,000 and above. I mean, I would submit that there are probably communities out there that you would say at 1,000 that there ought to be police
service. I guess
maybe
I'm trying to say I don't have a problem with mandating police protection for the residents of any community. I have a problem with mandating, maybe I have a problem with telling them they have to prosecute all their own crimes and hire their own DAs and all that kind of stuff. I probably have a problem there. But I mean, every citizen of the state should have a right to police protection of some sort. And when it's already being provided all around them, except this one neighborhood or this one area, Larry or Betty could probably speak to this. They have to deal with this all the time. I mean, there's a problem there. And so, anyway. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks.
Does anyone comment or Representative Davis?
Mr. Chairman, I guess, Scott, just a question. What would your membership, if you could just take, I mean, I understand I'm putting you in a position where they probably haven't taken a position, but what would your membership think about some kind of an agreement that we might make during the budget process with the administration that we would only fund trooper services to those areas of the state that cannot provide them for themselves and don't have the ability to go in and provide them for themselves?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davis, I think that decision was basically made, what, 4 or 5 years ago when it was put in as a letter of intent within the budget, and that's why Juneau ran around and did something, and it was sort of directed at Juneau and Anchorage at that time, and Juneau did something and Anchorage didn't in terms of this specific situation. And I guess that's what my membership sort of hangs its hat on in terms of the mandate issue, is that it really is a local problem and you ought to figure out some way to deal with it locally. I guess it is so focused on those two areas. And I understand that the Assembly has tried to do, or, I mean, there have been lots of attempts to try and do that. So I think that that's the best response that I can get. I think, I mean, that's what I was trying to get at, is that is your decision to say, look, we're not going to put troopers out there. And that those folks, when they don't see the troopers there, are going to get a little concerned because they're used to having a higher level of service than other communities that we must rely on troopers. Communities, I'm talking about neighborhoods in that community in that sense. And I think that that's what the commissioner tried to do. I mean, he gave them warning, I think it was November 1, that they were pulling them off the hillside, and I'm not sure what the result of that. I know there was a lot of local decisions, and Representative Davis and Representative Baker probably know more about it than I do in terms of the machinations that community went over in terms of just what they were paying for. And I think you got into, were they paying just for police service in that neighborhood, or we recognize the fact that they drive out of that neighborhood and they obviously providing, giving a service outside of the neighborhood as well, and so it's not just to provide it. They would just pay not just for that, quote, protection, sort of like the home watch situation, that they really are getting a full benefit of police service. So, again, saw that as a local issue. Back on another, you raised another side, I mean, the bill deals with home rule or general law city or unified municipality, so it rules out the Ketchikan situation. And Ketchikan City would have to apply. It would apply to Ketchikan City if it didn't already. I mean, they already.
But if they became
service.
Unified, then
if they became unified, then they would. Right.
So that would be a decision they would have to make on their own.
I mean, I think the commissioner's comment on the North Slope Borough deals with B, that if the borough provides that service area wide, then the city is not required to provide it as well. Which is what your comment is. Perhaps you think that maybe Ketchikan Borough ought to be providing that borough-wide, and then there, in that case, Ketchikan City would not have to. But that's a unique situation. But I think the bill really is directed at cities and unified municipalities to a large degree. I mean, Juneau is a city, even though it's a unified municipality.
Representative
Mackey,
I'm sorry to take too much time on this issue. I've been thinking about this a lot, and I think that as we are looking at really tough times, and how do we deal with some of these issues? I don't know, maybe the way to get at this one is to decide to cut the funding to communities that we do currently provide and replace the due state service statewide, and decide how it's apportioned based on population and crime statistics and whatever. I don't know. I'm just, it seems unfortunate to me that we have situations, and I offer up my own community as an example, where certainly residents of the borough and Ketchikan could easily afford to have police protection if they chose, but they haven't chosen to. This almost looks to me like we're talking about a disincentive for them. Maybe I could vote against it, justify voting against it, because it's a disincentive for them to form a borough. But I'm concerned that that's an issue we have to grapple with through legislation or the budget process, or both, that we can't afford to continue providing services to people who could easily afford to do that themselves. They just don't happen to choose to, and somehow or other they're going to have to.
If you'd like, we could include Ketchikan into this book. Require them to do their own.
They are included, Mr. Chairman.
I'll talk to the commissioner. I've got some serious concerns about that.
Do I understand this correctly? First of all, the position is that you're opposed to the bill because of the issue of mandates.
Correct.
But there is, you are having a problem, and I mean, there is people that feel differently within your organization about this actual bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, any organization that represents 120 municipalities, we have disagreements on lots of issues. But I mean, our position is, as a body, is to oppose mandates, and we see this as a mandate that can be addressed as a local decision. But I understand your position in that, at least in the Anchorage area, that attempt has been made and unsuccessful.
Yeah.
And also, in my view, in terms of mandates, that there are mandates in which the municipalities may be coming to the legislature saying, you don't mandate unless we ask you to. And I'm just saying, I'm not there yet. I mean, I don't have that position from my board. But it has been raised in terms of this may be one of those.
But I mean,
we're
the
not
point
there
I'm trying
yet.
To make is that this is not like a big unanimous thing, that the AML is just strongly opposed to this bill, because I think differently. I think there's a lot of merit to both sides of this issue, so it's just kind of a gut call. And I know that you're having a hard time with this issue, because there is a lot of merit both ways.
Mr. Chairman, we will be having a teleconference board meeting on another subject that I think we're all concerned about. And I did ask that this be raised at that time. I'm not suggesting you hold it up, but I will hopefully have a clearer position.
What's the position of the municipality of Anchorage?
I don't know.
Do you know?
I mean, specifically, I don't know what their position is. I mean, the issue was brought up
on
the floor, and they didn't vote against
you. That they, they have made an effort to try to take care of the problem themselves, and they're not able to do it, because as long as those people are going to continue to get protection, at least life and death protection, why should they vote a tax on themselves? And I mean, it's just something we have to deal with as a state.
Mr. Chairman, I think there are other folks that probably know the community better than I do, except others as a member and as a resident of Juneau. I think that's what they thought was going to happen 5 years ago, is that they weren't going to have the troopers that were being pulled out, and so they needed to do something. They wanted to fill that void. But I don't know that was done, except there was, this commissioner did in fact say as of November 1 we're going to be off the hillside, and lots of debate, but I didn't follow it because it's too far away from me in terms of the specifics, but I assume the representatives know.
Well, at least the day-to-day patrols that were going on in Juneau and the, the beat work and stuff, I mean, they still have a lot of communities, outlying communities, and it's the detachment headquarters for this detachment of the troopers. I have some familiarity there. That it's necessary for them to have a presence in Juneau, but I don't think they have the presence that they would have had if Juneau hadn't.
No, that's what I'm saying. They said, we're pulling out some number of troopers, and as a result, Juneau, and again, they don't cover every square foot. There's a roaded area and a non-roaded area that they deal with. But
anyway, I just wanted to make one other thing. I appreciate AML. I mean, we as a committee have been trying very hard to work with AML as a partnership, to address a lot of these things. And I haven't spoke with other members of this committee or anything, but I personally, as I told you today, feel that this is a necessary piece of legislation you know, and I am going to ask the committee to move it. I don't know how anybody else feels, but, you know, I mean, I think generally we try to take the municipality's position as much as possible, but this is kind of a unique situation, and I think you understand that. There's no one else signed up on this list. Is there anyone here present that would like to testify on this bill? Any other comments, Representative Gonzalez?
No, that's good. Unless there's other...
Yeah, any other committee members or comments? I was just kind of concerned about, you know, how the municipality of Anchorage might feel about it, since it does directly involve them, but I guess they'd be knocking on the door if they had a real problem with it, as they usually do.
Yeah, it's a couple other referrals here.
Commissioner?
Couple of real quick things, Mr. Chairman. I'll get out of here. I know you got other stuff to take care of.
I can say that I know in direct communications with the mayor of Anchorage and several other people and a number of the representatives and senators from the Anchorage area feel very strongly about the fact that Hillside should be some way to take on their own problems. The situation in Hillside, the Anchorage municipal charter is written different. I've looked at the charters of Anchorage, of Juneau, of Ketchikan, of Fairbanks, of all these major areas, and they're all written a little bit different, and that's where the fly in the ointment came in. When we talk about mandated services, my department, public safety, is mandated by state statute to enforce criminal laws in the state of Alaska. We're the only department in the state that is required to do that. Every municipality in the state of Alaska could decide tomorrow that they can't afford to any longer have a police department, and every city in the state could abolish their police departments, forcing the state to take it on. Now, I think they don't object about the mandated portions of the municipal code, which mandates that they raise taxes, or mandates that they control their own education system, or mandates, those are three mandated powers, to take and do their own planning and zoning. You know, I mean, let's have a fair balance here. If they don't like mandated services, take that away. We'll set their tax level for them in the municipalities and make sure we get enough money to have the troopers to police the entire city. We'll set the tax rate for education so we get over this fight about educational services. And we'll come in and do the planning and zoning for the cities if that's what they want. That objection to me falls a little bit of being frivolous, that they don't want mandated services. The police power comes to the state. If you want the privilege of being incorporated, then you take what goes with it. If you don't, then disincorporate, take what level of service the state can give you. I'm just tired of the arguments over this. Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? And I would recommend that we move the bill on to the next committee, if that's acceptable to the committee. Representative Gonzalez?
Mr. Chairman, okay, yeah, I move House Bill number 350 out of committee with the zero physical note, individual recommendations.
Any objection? Hearing none, bills. Okay. Next bill on the agenda, House Bill 390, Representative Boyer.
We're
not in teleconference.
Good. Well, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Mark Boyer, Representative of Downtown Fairbanks. Before you have a proposed or a CS from the Hess committee that substantially deviates from the bill that was originally introduced as a general obligation bond proposal for school construction projects across the state. It substantially deviates in a couple of ways. One, as you can see, the figure is substantially reduced from the original proposal, which was around $760 million. The second way that it is substantially different is that now we have in the proposal a match requirement by local communities for the projects themselves, with the exception of unincorporated communities where there is, in the version before you, no match expected. There are people here who may speak to the kind of larger issues, one of which is whether or not the state has the ability in its debt capacity, future debt capacity, to sustain this type of bonding proposal. I think all of you have generally been exposed to some of the issues, but the state of Alaska has not had a general obligation bond issue go to the public since 1980. There was a proposal in 1982 that went through the legislative process but was vetoed by the governor at the time. So it is a fairly new exercise that we're going through here, trying to determine whether or not we have the debt capacity, whether or not we have the need that is external or outside of the normal capital budgeting process for schools. My thinking and feeling is that we cannot, under the current system of HB 37, fund the both the priority one fire life safety issues in school districts, as well as meet the unhoused student needs in the larger urban districts without thinking expansively or quite differently from the way that we've been doing business. That was the original, my original desire was in meeting both of those needs simultaneously and taking some of the larger school district needs off the table so that HB 37, the construct that we now operate under for funding school construction and school projects, would be allowed to operate as we envisioned. I think all of you just literally have been exposed to this issue, and perhaps rather than me spending any additional time going over the background or what I think the need is, perhaps I could answer questions, or other members, other people who are in the audience could answer specific questions relative to debt capacity or the process by which the Department of Education formulates its list. One important piece of information, though, for the members of the committee is that we have tried to be apolitical in this whole process for the purposes of general discussion. And that's why we've used the construct of the HB 37 process. It yields priority one schools through priority seven projects. And in as much as that is an apolitical process, that's why we chose to use that construct here. The other construct that's here with regard to the local contribution is lifted from the governor's proposal on community matching grants. And that is a process whereby local wealth has been determined, or is determined by a process that gentlemen from OMB might be able to answer questions on. And from that assessment of local wealth, some judgment as to the ability to contribute locally has been assigned to those communities. And so we have not altered that formula whatsoever, nor have we altered the projects that have come from the Department of Education, other than to fully fund those projects where they are partially funded or phase funded on that list. For instance, Fairbanks High School appears on that list of 1 through 7 projects twice, one in the first phase and another in the second phase. And where you found projects like that, we collapsed the full cost of that project on the list, and we've done that across the board. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer questions, or as I've said, there are other people here to answer or deal with some of the other issues.
Questions from committee? Representative Betty Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was looking, there's another system of this tax, different from the one that came out of here.
I think, Mr. Chairman, actually what that is it should be a reflection of the bill that came out of HESS. The original bill had, I think, two positions attached to it.
Right.
The smaller amount of money, the fiscal note should have been revised to only one position. Yeah. And as I look at it,
so the 110 is the correct one?
Correct.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chairman, I'm kind of interested in knowing what the intention of the chair on this particular legislation today. Because I have some, and I shared this with the sponsor on Friday, some concerns about the makeup of the list, and he said, indicated to me that was a rather fluid process, so I'm wondering if we're going to be able to deal with that in this committee, or if what the intention is.
What is my intention with this
yes.
bill? Well, I don't know yet. I think the bill is going to be held to look at. Certain members of this committee have some concerns about the bill,
right.
Other than yourself. And
that's what my interest was. As a general theory, as I shared with the sponsor, I concur if we get by the bonding capacity issue, but then the composition of what's included is my next major issue, and I didn't know exactly how we were gonna get to deal with that in committee or whatever. But in theory, that's, we kind of feel that this is probably an appropriate action.
Well, I think it's safe to say that not only from an urban perspective, but there's some concerns about the actual projects that are included in this bill, but there are some concerns from a rural perspective as to how the local share of things were arrived at, and some of the REAAs that, you know, don't have a tax base or whatever that are included in here, and it's having to put up a local share. You know, I mean, those are all the types of questions. This is the first we've heard of the bill, and it just moved out of committee, and I scheduled it up right away for the sponsors so we can get rolling on the bill. I think my opinion is that bonding for these schools is probably one of the only ways that we're going to ever attack the problem that we face with $750 million worth of schools out there to build. We're never going to get to it by putting $25 million a year into it, but I mean, we've got to work through the process. And
well, the other concern too, Mr. Chairman, that I have is that some of this is not just new construction, it's actually R&M things. And as I discussed with the sponsor on Friday, I think that maybe the piece is more appropriately dealt with in the capital budget, and the new construction piece is more appropriately dealt with in this. But there are some concerns I know from our community about the composition of the list, and I know from your community the composition, so it's
well, if you're asking if we hold the bill, I mean, if that's what you're asking, you know, I can take that into consideration, and we can start going through. There's a number of people that have a lot of information, and see where we're at when we get to.
Well, I just didn't know whether you were going to move it, or the next committee was going to deal with it, or if we were going to get to have some input. That was.
Well, I think if you have some concerns, it should be addressed. Any member of this committee, I try not to move bills until we're all as comfortable as we can be. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the fact that this committee's got to get familiar with the concept and all of that, and I, you know, will support whatever you want to do. Let's see, 1, 2, 3 of us saw the bill in Hess and worked in the subcommittee, and, oh, well, 2 of us saw the bill in Hess, 1 of us was on. So 2 of us at least are very familiar with the bill and all of the concepts therein, but we'll be happy to work with the committee in any way you choose to look at that. I did want to ask the sponsor one question that occurred to me, but we were running out of time and asked when we were ready to move the bill out. There seemed to be some concerns expressed that perhaps the priorities that communities expressed at whatever time that ended up on 1s and 2s in the DOE's list might not be those same priorities if given an opportunity to look at potentially a bond package. And I guess I'm curious if there is a mechanism, if you're aware, and maybe this is an appropriate question for Dwayne, if you're aware if there's a mechanism for communities to be asked to take a new look and say, is this still your top priority? You know, are these still your top priorities, or do these things still fit your criteria for what you think your community needs the most if we were to pass legislation like this? I don't want to get into the pork barrel approach to this thing. I would still like to stay as close as we can within DOE type guidelines as to what's an appropriate project. I happen to agree with Representative Baker that some of the things may be more maintenance type things versus new construction that would may or may not be appropriate for this kind of a list. But given outside of that, perhaps there should be an opportunity for communities to say, re-update their list and have DOE then take a look at those and see if they've changed substantially from what's contained in here.
It's my understanding, Representative Boyer, that this list is the top, however many, right off the top of the list of DOE's priority list, right?
It is all the world of all 1s and 2s.
Right.
And I mean, there's not any pork barreling going on here in this particular, the way you've got the bill presented to us now.
Correct.
And I know that there is a lot of people that are suggesting maybe we ought to do a combined package and some urban and rural type things, but I mean, you know, I'm wondering how healthy that is to even get into those kind of conversations when that was the reason that the priority list was, why you guys decided to go this route in the first place, was to take the politics out of it.
Right.
And to suggest that maybe communities might want to alternate their priorities or something. They aren't decided on a capital priority list, CIP list from communities. They're decided on by priority according to a strict set of criteria as determined by DOE. Is that correct?
That's correct. The criteria are there, and they have a review process, a review panel, and
The difference, though, I think, is that there is a clear difference in the way a voter might approach a project. And, for instance, Representative Baker mentioned perhaps only dealing with new construction. Well, we took a glance at the list that's before you in the bill, and about $11.2 million, I think, somewhere in that neighborhood anyway, would come off a list if you were only looking at new construction, replacement construction, or major additions, which we characterize if you're going to add classrooms, real additions, new construction that way, that it would qualify. But primarily that $11 million comes off of the priority one projects, roof repairs and some of those types of things. And those could clearly be, it's actually $11.9 million, could come under the normal capital budgeting process. But if you were a voter and you were looking at voting in your own community for instance, a roof and wall replacement, you might not want to bond locally or contribute locally for that kind of a project as opposed to a new classroom addition. So if in the priority though of things that roof repair posed a health or safety issue, it would appear on the department's list higher than the replacement, which in the whole scheme of things, as you were replacing or adding an addition, you might take care of the roof issue, attend to do that. But it's as a voter, you might make a different choice. So what we want to make sure of as we structure the bill is that we have projects that are the highest priorities for that community and ones that they would support locally if they were asked to come up with some local match for that. And I think the issues before the committee that are important are the general issue of local contribution, whether or not communities across the state, regardless of size, regardless of incorporation, ought to be expected to contribute something for these projects, not only in this exercise, but how we set the tone for the future. That's an important issue. This committee is clearly, I think, the appropriate one to deal with that issue. The issue of the projects themselves probably fall more into line with the general capital budget approach, and yet I'd certainly appreciate the guidance of the subcommittee or of this committee on how that package comes together. The overall issue of debt capacity is one that I think the Finance Committee is interested in looking at in the whole scheme of things, the overall backdrop of revenues. Future revenues and ability of the state to pay off this debt. The governor's, and I don't speak for the governor clearly, but the indications from the governor's office are that they are very much interested, if we move ahead with any amount of new debt, that it be secured with some kind of repayment mechanism. And as you know, we passed the bill last year on the debt retirement fund. We have not capitalized it. There's no mechanical capitalization of that fund, and neither is there a dedicated revenue stream to that as was envisioned by the governor. And I think that the dedicated revenue piece of that is still in the House Finance Committee.
Okay, anything else from anywhere?
No, I think that there are other people who can touch on some of the others, if I may join.
Yeah,
you.
Please do. Rod?
Right.
Oh, okay, you're just available for questions? Okay, Tom Bolton?
Yep, thanks.
Good afternoon.
Hoody, thanks for asking me. Come over. I'm Tom Buchan from the Department of Revenue. I guess you all have a copy of a letter which was sent today to, this same letter was sent to Representative Boyer and Representative Navarre, and I think I'll just focus on that. I do have the same presentation I've made before on state debt and different kinds of state debt and different kinds of security for a state of Alaska debt. But and so, you know, whatever you want to ask. But briefly, the State Department of Revenue and the State Bond Committee have used the definition of debt capacity that the state has used is that debt service wouldn't exceed 5% of unrestricted revenues. This fiscal year, debt service will probably be 9.2% of unrestricted revenues. Using that definition, and again in this letter which is dated today from Darrell Rexwinkle, there is no capacity to issue additional general obligation debt, and as you see under the mid scenario, $22 million of general obligation debt could be issued in 1996. Briefly, it would take a different definition of debt capacity to incur additional general obligation debt. Apart from the question of debt capacity, separate from that, is the confines of the Prudhoe curve. There's a unanimous consensus among the people I work for that the maturity of any general obligation debt, if it were issued and was not funded by something apart from unrestricted revenues, such as a funded debt retirement fund, the maturity should be limited to 7 years at the outside. And if you start doing the math of what the debt service would be on debt that has a final maturity of only 7 years, you have to look at funding any project from cash rather than issuing debt as an alternative, because the cash amounts and the debt service are about equal, and by issuing the debt, you incur the issuance costs and the interest expense. I think that maturity situation is separate and from the lack of debt capacity that the state has.
Can I ask a question right there?
Sure,
it's my understanding that the debt capacity will not expand until 1998. Is that what's being projected?
Well, in this letter under the spring revenue forecast, the long-range forecast, I guess, will be released Monday, I guess, or maybe Friday. Under the mid-scenario, the state has no debt capacity until FY96. Under the high scenario, it has the capacity to issue debt in fiscal year 1995, again, using the definition of debt capacity that debt service won't exceed 5% of unrestricted revenues.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Unrestricted revenues is strictly the stream off of Prudhoe oil wealth to the state. It doesn't include anything like the earnings from the permanent fund or any of those kinds of
things? It includes earnings on the general fund and other earnings that are available to be lapsed into the general fund, but you're right, it does not include reserves such as the earnings reserve of the permanent fund.
Or it certainly wouldn't include an income tax because we have none now.
That's right, the revenue forecast doesn't include revenues from sources that might develop at some point in the future.
I didn't catch it. Does it also include the earnings of the permanent fund?
No. Earnings of the general fund are included in unrestricted revenue, as well as fish taxes, but certainly the predominant source is petroleum related.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that it's very significant how much the statewide bonded indebtedness drops off in the fairly near future from what it has been. And in fact, if it goes down, it looks like to me it goes down to 1979 days or something within 3 or 4 years. So we're not talking about something that, I mean, if we could sustain a certain level of debt in those days, for us to assume that we can't sustain any level of debt in the future seems to me kind of, or very, you know, minuscule level of debt in the future seems to me. I mean, I understand why you're making those assumptions. I guess I'm just trying to make a point that there are ways and then there are ways to look at those.
Yeah,
things.
Well, we do use the revenue forecast, and as we all know, revenues are forecasted to drop off also. Clearly, if revenues were from some source that was level or was to keep pace with the rate of inflation, then debt capacity would be freed up real fast. But under the situation that the state has, then the petroleum revenues pretty well drive what kind of capacity the state has to use leverage.
Thank you.
Okay.
Just to make a couple of points, Mr. Chairman, this is a very conservative approach of characterizing debt capacity, and I think that that's where we ought to be. We ought to be approaching this very cautiously and very conservatively. But if you only looked at the opportunity to backfill new debt in the context of the drop in real GO bond debt or GO debt and the school debt combined, I mean, the reduction over the next 24 months, it drops almost in half. Those two alone drop almost in half. That is an opportunity to backfill with new debt, as I see it, without doing any harm. And that opportunity is clearly within the context of a $300 million proposal that's on the table. That assumes a fairly aggressive, though, approach, I think, which is different than the one manifest here. But you know, just the fact that the administration is willing to have this discussion at all is an indicator of opportunity, I think. In my short few years around here, the administration has not even been willing to talk about this. And it's been good in the sense that it has left us in this opportunity, given us the opportunity to issue some new debt. So I just want to say that I think it is a conservative approach, and we should be conservative in this. My original proposal was just to put it all on the table, and it got some attention. But it's clearly not the direction that I think we should go at this point.
Does revenue have an official position on the bill?
I think in this letter, it's I guess I'd call it an official position. If I could just read it, please.
Okay.
Beg your pardon. I think it is possible to summarize the credit rating aspects, debt capacity, and alternatives available in very simple terms. The general obligation credit ratings are not inviolate, but should be maintained at the highest practical level. The issuance of a large amount of additional general obligation debt could precipitate a credit downgrade, but would not necessarily be expected to do so if the authorization was preceded by the authorization of a directly funded debt retirement fund or some other factor which improves the outlook for bondholder repayment. The issuance of a large amount of general obligation debt with debt service schedule beyond 5 to 7 years could produce rating agency suspension or withdrawal of ratings. The possible fiscal implications of using debt to supplement falling revenues are potentially more severe than are any concerns related to credit ratings. And Rod actually can talk too, if you'd like, certainly about better than I can about the Department of Revenue policy. Okay.
Rod?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rod Morant, and I'm Special Assistant Commissioner of Revenue, General Rexwinkle. And let me just say at the outset that we certainly support the concept of finding a mechanism to fund additional school construction, school repair efforts, and we recognize the need and the shortage of classroom space and the deteriorating facilities that we are operating in the state. I can say that the official position of the agency in regard to CSHB 390 Hess, short of an additional funding mechanism, is to oppose the legislation. If, in fact, funding was available to fund the debt retirement fund, which was established last year in Chapter 87, SOB 91, that the governor would wholeheartedly give us a closer look and a possible consideration.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, Rod, and maybe hopefully you're the right person to ask this question of, if the administration were presented with two alternatives, one that we do this kind of an approach, and the other was that we go back to a system of allowing communities to bond for schools that they feel they need 70-30% or something like that, where they had an unlimited ability to go out and bond for whatever they felt they needed in their community, as we had in the old days before House Bill 37 was passed. Which of those alternatives would the administration prefer?
Well, Representative Davis, to the chair, in regard to the old system of reimbursement and state debt retirement, our concern, bottom line concern, I couldn't speak to what the governor's position would be on that, but our concern would be the effect of withdrawing additional general funds for future state operations, state programs, off the table by forcing debt retirement. And that was the whole concept behind establishing the debt retirement fund, was not to have that effect by getting a perpetuating funding mechanism to allay future debts. And short of that funding, you're talking about taking the real general fund cash that's available on a year-to-year basis for debt retirement. And the subsequent effect of that on state operations and the affording of state operations is pretty dramatic.
Representative Boyer?
The position of the department is a new position, one in opposition without their bill. And that's, it hasn't been presented that way in prior committees. And I think the linkage is okay, but I want, you know, this committee should appreciate that the department has not come forward and opposed this bill at any other juncture thus far. But they're clearly looking for some linkage that would elevate their comfort level. But the issue of taking money off the table as it affects future operations of state government is exactly what the governor's debt proposal does, is it takes money off the table because it takes a stream of money that now accrues to the general fund and is available for general obligations of government. It takes it off the table. So that's exactly what the governor's proposal does, absent a capitalization of that fund. And I think that some of the discussion I've been hearing is to perhaps capitalize that fund with permanent fund earnings reserve monies, for instance. That is one funding source that wouldn't result in reduction of monies otherwise available for general operations of state government. But perhaps Rod would like to talk about where that issue is.
And through the chair, Representative Boyer, and let me apologize. I can't speak to what the agency has done in the past. I don't know what the track record is of the agency in regard to your legislation in testimony or submitted documentation in the past. But let me just say that we have no opposition to the concept of the legislation whatsoever. It is paying for the concepts contained in that legislation for which we have a concern. And I agree with you that a mechanism for funding the debt retirement fund would be the answer. And what that mechanism is, I can't speak to.
Any other comments? Thanks, Rod.
Thank you.
I want to go to Royce Weller, the gentleman in the Rod's office.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Royce Weller. I'm an aide to Representative Navarre. I'd like to emphasize I'm not here to speak on the merits of any of the projects contained in House Bill 390, but on general obligation bonding in general. Mr. Chairman, Alaska stands alone among all the energy-producing states, Texas, Oklahoma, California, Louisiana, Wyoming, that has not suffered a downgrading in its bond rating, GO bond rating, in the last decade. And the reason for this, Mr. Chairman, is that the state has followed a very conservative debt management policy. As Tom Boutin, the Department of Revenue, has pointed out, it's essentially two parts, the 5% rule and the debt from the charities should be short, essentially right now, about a 7-year time period. Mr. Chairman, recently some individuals have implied that the debt management policy in some way has been adopted on an ad hoc basis. From 76 forward. This essentially is not true, Mr. Chairman. The debt management policy that the state follows right now was deliberately adopted, and it was adopted in part by communications with the rating agencies, communications with the state's financial advisor, and on a legislative-funded report. In 1982, LB&A contracted with an outside firm to review the debt capacity and debt management of the state of Alaska. And that's this 260-page document right here, which contains, as Representative Boyer indicated, a conservative approach to the management of general obligation debt in the state of Alaska. Primarily, this was due to the fact that we are tied to the wealth extracted from Prudhoe Bay and the vulnerability of that wealth due to fluctuations in the price. Representative Navarro is concerned that we move cautiously in the area of issuing any new GO debt. And Mr. Chairman, if I could, one excerpt from this report, contained on page 220 states that if the state maintains this ratio, which is the 5-6% rule of debt service to unrestricted general fund revenues, and continues to issue debt with maximum maturities within the known and predictable revenue range, it is likely the state's creditworthiness will be preserved. And essentially that's been the policy followed by a number of administrations, both Democrat and Republican, for over the last decade. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions?
Okay, thank you.
Eric Wolfert, I believe. Pronounce that right?
That's right, Mr. Hey, Chairman.
Wolfert, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Eric Wolfert, and I've been counsel for the four boroughs, municipalities, as they met to assist in devising a general obligation bond program for schools. They haven't seen the committee substitute here, but I would like to speak, make some general comments on the subject of state debt capacity. My background is 35 years as bond attorney with specialized emphasis in public finance. I'd just like to make a few observations to help set the whole bond picture in context. I will say that the February 12 hearing of the Joint Finance Committees was a valuable start towards reintroducing the concept of bonding public finance to the state as a legitimate and recognized mechanism to raise capital improvement funds. Other states have continued to borrow for capital improvements while Alaska suspended its program of general obligation borrowing by the legislature, not advancing to the people the proposition of propositions for general obligation bonds. And of course, any bond that would be bonds that would be voted by the legislature would be a subject to the check of voter approval this fall, should they be voted. It's important to recognize that the AA, the high ratings the state enjoys, are really meaningful and useful if the state borrows money. Continued high ratings in the AA and AAA capacity is advantageous, and as rightfully the state may take pride in that, and we all may take pride in it, are really directly beneficial only to existing bondholders, unless the state exercises or begins to exercise, even in a modest way, its general obligation borrowing ability. Mr. Chairman, 23 out of 33 state governors in their State of the Union or State of the State addresses this year have indicated that those states were going to consider general obligation bonding for the necessary public improvements that those states face, even though they at the same time face the cash stringency and shortfalls that we know about through our recession periods. So other states are continuing to consider and are exercising the general obligation, their general obligation bonding ability. What does debt capacity mean? It may mean, and I'm not sure how it's used before you, that a substantial amount of bond issuance beyond the 7 year that the Department of Revenue says may result in a rating downgrade. What does a rating downgrade mean? That's an essential question to ask. What does a rating downgrade mean from a AA to an A level? Does it mean a 5 basis points increase in borrowing costs? Does it mean a 15 basis points or 0.15% increase in borrowing costs? Those are questions which must be addressed, and I hope that this committee will sponsor, or the Finance Committee will sponsor, a follow-on educational session so that these questions may be addressed. Mr. Chairman, I simply wanted to introduce some of these items to you. I know your time is short and you have others to hear from. I commend the start of reconsideration of what is a legitimate subject for states to consider, what other states have continued to do what I think Alaska is on the verge of doing again. Examine, if you will, the subject of what is debt capacity, or referring to debt downgrade. Examine whether it is absolutely the case that any debt has to be limited to 7 years, general obligation debt of 10 or 15 or 20 years may indeed be possible if the matter is studied carefully. I think all these are considerations for what I would suggest should be even a broader inquiry than was initially made at the before the finance committees in February. And certainly I'd be happy to appear again at any such inquiry.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if this is an appropriate question, but you can tell me if it's not. If I were going to come to you as a private citizen and ask to borrow money and for some purpose, say I wanted to buy a house or you name it, and I had an income of but I also had some very high level securities in the bank, tons and tons of them, from which I had an income stream. Would you or would you not consider that in the process of seeing what capacity you would be willing to loan me?
If I was a banker, I think I would. Certainly that's a legitimate element of anyone's borrowing capacity.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Boyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Eric, you, in working with the boroughs, came up with some sensitivity of how you would probably characterize the state's ability to borrow, and it manifests in a number, a dollar number. How did you arrive at that? And because it touches on the questions you thought and you suggested we need to ask, but what did you go through in your analysis?
Well, I think if I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Boyer, there is a... this is not a precise art, not a precisely quantifiable figure. I mean, one sense of philosophy is what the state's going to be in 7 or 10 years comes into play. I personally don't think, even though the Prudhoe curve suggests this very, very rapid and stark downturn in 7 or 10 years, that public policy planning ought to be based on a hypothesis that there'll be no substantial revenues to repay debt at that period of time. We don't have, if you will, Representative Boyer, a specific number that we can say this is the state's debt capacity and above that not. And I suggest that it is not quantifiable precisely. The unfortunate part of the public policy thing is you'll hear differing testimony, differing good faith testimony as to what is possible. We heard from Standard & Poor's, their representative, Chris Irwin, when he was here, that the maintenance of the state's bond rating should not be the only criteria in determining whether we go forward with general obligation debt. This from a rating agency. So it's a broader picture, a more complicated picture than might be suggested at the first examination.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate you being here. Dwayne Wiley. Wiley, did I pronounce it right? Oh, I'm sorry. I said you didn't want to testify, but you have a question. Anything that stimulated you to testify?
Mr. Chairman, I'm here for, my name is Dwayne Gatt. I'm here from the Department of Education, just answering questions you have about the ranking process or the list that was prepared that purpose in Representative Boyer's bill.
Any questions for DOE?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davis, Betty Davis.
Perhaps Dwayne could speak to what Representative Sherry Davis was asking about, a more up-to-date list from the district.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davis, annually the districts present to the Department of Education their list of projects that they wish to have funded within that fiscal year. So again, next year we would have before you another list that represents the district's concerns of projects they would like to have funded within that fiscal year. What we find in that list as it comes forward each year, it's a six-year capital improvement plan. Projects that are on the list for funding this year, if they're not in fact funded by the legislature, many of those same projects remain on the list next year to be funded in FY94. Some projects in fact drop off and are replaced with other priorities. And again, that's decided at the local level. Normally they have three readings at their board level, and it's voted on by their board and submitted under the superintendent's signature and the board's signature.
Can I just follow up? Has there been any dialogue from the district saying that now that I know that there's this bonding capacity, probably maybe we might need to look at this again? Because I know that some of the larger districts have gotten together. We're talking about some of the things they'd like to see happen. And they're coming up with a different list than what's on this list.
Mr. Chairman, as soon as word got out of Representative Boyer's first bill of $760 million, school districts began to call to ask if they could change their list. Because they hadn't thought that anyone would take it seriously down to that level. And they said they had other higher priorities that weren't reflected on that list. And I told them that their next opportunity to change the list was next school year.
Thank you.
Okay.
Someone's being consistent anyway, right?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Jack Bartignoli, is that right?
No.
Sorry, I'm having trouble reading to the right here today. From OMB? Are you guys brothers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jack Bartignoli. I'm a senior policy analyst with the Office of the Director of OMB. I, too, am here to answer questions or describe briefly, if the committee would like it, on the use of the local cheer factors in Representative Boyer's bill, which, as you know, are the same factors and the same rationale for them that was used in Governor Hagel's proposed capital project expansion grant program. So if you'd like, I can synopsize briefly how they were generated and what they portend or pretend to be, or simply answer questions.
Sure. If you could do that, I'd appreciate that.
Okay.
And just briefly, how you arrived at that schedule?
And we recently took a look at all municipalities and trying to determine how one might go about estimating what their ability to share, to participate financially in a capital project would be, or how you might differentiate among them, given their obviously different capabilities financially. We came up with a set of formulas that basically take into account their population and their local wealth. Local wealth, we use their assessed valuation as an indicator of what their local wealth would be. And for purposes of simplicity and consistency for both the population data for the communities and the assessed valuation, we use the figures that are generated by the Department of Community and Regional Affairs for their revenue sharing program. So they'd be the same as those, and people knew those and were familiar with them. So essentially the formula that we used to determine what the local share would be to take a population factor times a local wealth factor, and that would generate the local share expressed as a percentage. So that's the overall shape of the formula. And taking them piece by piece, the population factor, we assigned different weights to communities depending on what their population was, to try and capture the differences in their fiscal capacity, their access to capital, their regional differences in the cost of doing business, and there are obviously the difference between a very small community and a very large community, the differences in their enjoyment or non-enjoyment of economies of scale. So we stratified the municipalities into four groups: those over 10,000, those between 5 and 10,000, those below between 1 and 5,000, and those below 1,000. To each of those, we assigned the factor, starting with the largest communities. We gave them, we set them as the standard or reference. We gave them a weighting of 1.0. For communities between 5 and 10,000, we gave them a factor of 0.7. Between 1,000 and 5,000, we gave them a factor of 0.3. And the other 1,000, we gave them a factor of 0.1. What that means, essentially, is that all other things being equal, a community under 1,000 population with a population factor of 0.1 would be basically responsible for 10% of the local share that a larger community like Anchorage would be. So you would have 10%, 30%, 70%. And then for those over 10,000, 100%. So that was the way we grouped them. Now the grouping process is more a matter of consensus than of empirical investigation. There was a lot of discussion initially last session when this was brought up on the Senate side, in the Senate CNRA committee, and we discussed it quite a bit with the communities themselves and with the Department of Community and Regional Affairs. So we felt that that was at least a reasonable basis for grouping them. They obviously can be grouped according to a number of different ways, but those dimensions of access to capital and economies of scale are difficult to get to without a rather elaborate effort and a lot of hypothesizing on people's parts. So that represented our best guess as to how to stratify them and how to weight them. moving to the local wealth factor, what we essentially did was look at the assessed valuation of all the municipalities in the state, all their population, from those two numbers generate a statewide average per capita valuation, then compare each municipality's per capita valuation against that statewide average. The statewide average would be 1.0. If a particular municipality had a ratio of 0.3, basically they were a third as wealthy as per capita as the average municipality. If they had a factor of 2.0, they would be roughly, they would be twice as wealthy per capita as the average municipality. Once we generated those factors, as I said initially, we multiplied the population factor times the local wealth factor. That gave the percentage of the local share. So if a given community had a local share percentage of 20%, that meant that they would be responsible for 20% of the, their share would be 20% of the total project. Representative Boyer's bill, he's identified the amounts of the bond proceeds that would be allocated to each project. If you know the dollar amount that represents the state share in dollars, and you know the local percentage share, well, from the local percentage share, you can subtract from one and get the state percentage share, and then knowing three of the four quantities, you can determine what the local share in dollars is supposed to be. And so that's what has been done by Representative Boyer and his staff. In a nutshell, that's how we went about it, and that's what's in SB 141, the governor's bill. So I'd be happy to give you more detail or respond to questions if you like.
Yeah, I was just curious, do you have that analysis written up?
Yes, we do, and I can provide
if you
the basic
can provide
information.
That in just the time, we can distribute to the committee members, and maybe we can better understand, because I know there are a lot of questions as to how you arrived at those types of numbers. And
okay, we
have
like
a... Sounds like it's pretty simple, but if you could give that to us in writing, I'd be happy to give that to the rest of the community.
Okay, we have an information kit for SB 141 with the sectional analysis and then also a description of how those formulas work.
If OMB can provide that analysis of this particular legislation for this committee, I would appreciate that. It sounds like it would be relatively easy to do since the formula is in place.
Sure.
How it applies here. Okay.
Be happy to.
Great. Any other questions? Comments for Jim Boyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it may be a major jump for people to appreciate the formula in a context of only giving money away. And in its other context here, which is in having to contribute money for a project. If you're thinking in terms of $100,000 and your ability to access that $100,000 and your ability to pay, that's different than a project that maybe is several millions of dollars in size. And I think it's the relativity issue that has people spooked, because if you looked at the way the governor's proposal, the legislative proposal moved through the body last year, it was not substantially altered. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So people were able to make the connection between some local contribution based on local wealth and ability to generate dollars. And yet it was in perhaps a smaller context than is envisioned in this bill. And so we shouldn't be, I hope, frightened at the magnitude of contribution, local effort, or local initiative because of the magnitude of the dollars. Don't let the dollars drive that decision. If you're able to give at one level, I mean, you're in theory able to give generally, but or participate. But Jack, can you tell us how you envision REAAs participating in projects? Now, that's a little different than the backdrop of the governor's original proposal, but REAAs in this case may well be the recipients of projects, and yet they're an entity that doesn't have an ability to tax directly. But how do you see them fitting in there?
Well, that's difficult for me to say, Representative Boyer, Mr. Chairman. We have not dealt with them in the governor's legislation, and personally not dealing with REAAs, I can't really speak to their mechanisms for accessing what fiscal capacity they have. We'd be happy to get that testimony and provide it if that would help the committee, but the SB 141 experience, we have not treated with that whatsoever. So we've dealt only with unincorporated communities, which we give a flat grant to, and then municipalities per se. So I'd be happy to prepare
that. That would be helpful information, because I see in the bill one community, for example, is in an REAA and would be asked to contribute $34,000 on a $600,000 project versus another REAA that would be asked to contribute nothing, or
and there are several different REAAs that have local match factors in there, so I was kind of curious to, you know, how, I mean, is it going to be like a straight across board for all REAAs, or is a determination of how wealthy that particular community, whether it's incorporated or unincorporated, going to be factored in wherever that school is, or some of those are some of the questions that I had, but we are out of time and resources needs this committee right now, so maybe we could, if we can get that stuff from you, I'll distribute it to the other members. Anyone else that has a burning desire to jump right up? Okay, what I'm going to do is ask Richard Foster to chair a subcommittee with Sherry Davis and Larry Baker, and perhaps they can have some meetings and address things and report back. Okay. If nothing else, we'll extend the adjournment.
I like your work.